And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. During an extended stay in the intensive care unit of a hospital, it's common for patients to experience delirium of one form or another. And patients may begin to see or hear things that aren't there. They may experience delusions or even paranoia, or they may quietly lose grasp of reality, where they are, for instance, or who their loved ones are. So this hour, we want to talk with medical professionals about the causes of this condition, hospital delirium, how it impacts patients and families, what's being done to prevent this, as it turns out, very common occurrence in hospital wards. And we'll also hear from someone in a moment whose partner experienced delirium during several of his hospital stays. We want to reach out to you, our listeners, via email only this half hour, not telephone, via email. Share with us your experience if you have or a loved one has experienced delirium connected with a hospital stay. Tell us about it in an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. That's rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining me for this half hour, Dr. Nick Butler. He's a geriatrician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, assistant clinical professor of family medicine. Dr. Butler, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Desi Myers is with us as well. She's a nurse, an RN, and pulmonary case manager at the Iowa City Veterans Administration Healthcare System. Desi, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
And Mary Mixdorf is with us, resident of Iowa City. Her husband passed away a few years ago, and before he did, he experienced delirium off and on for several years. Mary, welcome to you. Thank you for coming and to share your experience.
Thank you.
Before we get to Mary's experience there, Dr. Butler, help us understand a little bit more about what we're talking about, how often it happens, under what conditions, and what exactly we're talking about.
I think your explanation there to open the segment is actually quite good. I think this is under-identified as a whole. I think if you look at some ICU data, for example, I think that's where it tends to happen most frequently. In numbers I've read, 50% or greater of people who are in the ICU end up experiencing delirium. Really what delirium is it's this it's an acute issue, so it's a new onset. This isn't something that happens. It's a change from baseline. And what it is it's acute change in someone's cognition. So they don't remember things as clearly. They may not have attention like they used to. They hallucinate. And it can be very distressing, I think, to family members and loved ones because it's like I said, it's an acute and drastic change from someone's normal kind of cognitive baseline.
Can be acute and drastic, but there is a whole spectrum. It can be mild to just confusion about where you are and who's standing next to the bed and so forth, all the way to extreme paranoia?
Absolutely. I think and that's the trouble with this is I think part of the reason it's under-recognized is because there's a spectrum of hyperactive delirium, and those are the ones that people all identify with, where they're confused, they're throwing things, they're yelling. But then there's hypoactive delirium, and those are the individuals who may just be picking at their clothes, maybe not attentive to things, maybe a little bit more confused, but they're the quiet, sleepy one in the room that they just don't get as much attention, and because of that the hypoactive kind of component to it. And it is a very wide spectrum of things. And so it's really, I think, from a physician standpoint, the best and most helpful thing for me is hearing from family members that their loved one just isn't acting like they normally do.
That is your cue to pay more attention.
That's a cue that they're different from baseline.
Okay.
Yep.
Reach out to our listeners now that we have from Dr. Butler a little better idea of what we're talking about in terms of the spectrum of delirium people can experience in the hospital. I'll mention that email once again to write your experiences, 1-866. Well, sorry, that's the telephone, of course, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Mary Mixdorf with us. Your husband, Gordon, before his death in 2016, experienced hospital delirium, I understand, off and on for many years. Let me first say, I'm sorry for the passing of your husband, but thank you for coming in to share so that others can learn from this experience. Tell us, when was the first time your husband, Gordon, experienced delirium? What happened?
I really don't remember the first time. It happened frequently, usually after he had an infection of some time and was admitted to the hospital. I think perhaps he probably had incidents at home. I was his full-time caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
And we would kind of pass it off as, just something happening. But in the hospital, it was intense and scary.
Right.
Because you didn't know whether he was aware. Sometimes he would call my name every 20 seconds over and over. And I would assure him I was there and everything was going to be okay. But it didn't help him stop. He continued or might call a nurse over and over.
So what could you decipher in the mild form and then later when it became more intense? What was he having problems with?
The time it took for him to come out of it. It might be a full day. And then the next morning, we'd say, Gordon's back. He's sitting up, smiling. You know.
What was he like when he was gone, when he was not there? What sort of behavior? What would he say?
Well, he'd repeat words the same time. Sometimes he would imagine there were things in the other room that he would hear, and he would, you know, just tell us very clearly exactly what was happening.
Were they frightening things to him?
No, distressing things, maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean,
do you have an example?
Well, he kept saying that person next door would be, he's hurting somebody or he's doing something. He was making up a story about, there was nothing next door.
So it was as if he had some insights into an alternate reality he was making you aware of.
Right. Oftentimes he would grab at the air. I mean, just his hands would grab and we'd say, what are you looking? Well, I'm looking for the button. And, you know, he would try to turn a button and we'd say, there's no button. And,
so he was having a delusion that there was a hallucination right in front of him, Dr.
And I think that's a very common thing, this kind of picking behavior at the sheet as though they're attending to something that's there. That hallucination is a very common.
The picking thing was another thing. Finally, the nurse would give him a towel. Because he would pick at that. One time he folded this towel over and over and over all day. He would just fold this towel like he knew how to do your laundry or something.
Mm-hmm. And this was happening for over 5-6 years in the last part of his life. Did it get worse, the instances in intensity?
I don't know that it was really worse. They were different. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they were, very annoying and disturbing. And other times you kind of thought, well, he's going to get through. At home, he was in a wheelchair, a power chair. Mm-hmm. And sometimes he couldn't remember how to drive it. Or he would try to drive it. And little things like that. He was pretty sharp as far as he was a government teacher, so he was pretty sharp on facts. He didn't lose that. But in the hospital, quite often, they would ask him where he was, and he didn't know what day. Usually got the president.
The president at the current time, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Desi Myers is with us. As well as Mary Mixdorf. Mary, you were just listening to her husband experienced hospital delirium on and off for years before his death in 2016. Desi Myers with us, an RN, a pulmonary case manager at the Iowa City Veterans Administration healthcare system. You have, Desi, a lot of firsthand experience when people slip into delirium, probably countless cases where you have seen varying degrees of what we're describing.
Right. And the ICU, it's, you know, the whole reason you're there is for intense monitoring so that you notice as soon as possible when any change is made. And one of the most important assessments you can do is their mental status. And so it's very common for people to get like hourly mental status exams. Tell me your name, where you are, date, mm-hmm. those kind of things. Mm-hmm. But then the flip side of that is one of the pretty prominent causes of delirium is sleep deprivation. So if you wake somebody up every hour, then you don't know if you're catching the delirium or causing it. And so, you know, there used to be a name for, they used to call it more like ICU psychosis or ICU syndrome. And it's delirium is what it is. And so the ICU is not a restful place. Everything is beeping all the time. There's always a crisis in some part of the unit. And so sleep is a real problem. I know a patient that we had that was through a really serious illness and was younger, so in some ways less likely to get delirium. Older people are more likely. But he'd been in the ICU so long. And so we were trying to get him out of the ICU to improve. And he was so delirious that he wasn't really very safe. And so what we ended up getting was a net bed, which is sort of like a crib, but for an adult. Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of zipped him in there. And he like slept for one night and then woke up much, much improved. And so it's a hard balance to find for sure.
Right. And I imagine when you have sort of the inward looking delirium, the calmer delirium that Dr. Butler there described compared to the hyper delirium, where do you have cases where patients act out in a way that is a danger to him or herself or to the staff?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. They'll strike or try to get out of bed or fall. And so that's also a really hard balance because we want to keep them safe. So one of the things you do is restrain them. So you would like tie down their arms and legs, which is very distressing. And
sure. So
it's really hard to connect with someone that has such irrational thoughts like you have in delirium.
And at the same time, you may have family members in the room and
yes.
you're tying down a loved one. Wow,
yeah.
That is a tough thing
for sure.
to negotiate, isn't
it? And so,
it?
Yeah, we just try to do a lot of education about why it's important and try to get it removed as soon as possible. The thing that's sort of interesting about delirium is they have such disorganized thoughts and they're so unable to like get in touch with reality, but then they still get certain parts. So they'll be like, hey, get that chicken out of the room, but then they'll also be like, get me a knife so I can cut this off. So they get parts of the reality, but they just can't put it all together. And yeah.
Dr. Butler.
And that's one of the major things with delirium that tips you off that it's something that's delirium rather than something like psychosis from schizophrenia or depression. It has this waxing and waning nature to it, and it can be minute to minute, hour to hour, to day to day, where for example, I've had some individuals where they get discharged from the hospital and they still have moments in each day when they're at home where they have acute confusion, where they just aren't quite themselves, but the rest of the day they're their normal selves. And so we see that fluctuation in the hospital. We see it even after discharge, and sometimes just getting them out of the health care system and getting them back to their usual environment is very important for treating this. And I think that is one of the difficult negotiations with family members of, you've got this loved one who has this delirium, and it's very overwhelming to care for and manage, but getting them out of the hospital is maybe the most important step sometimes after you've obviously treated the underlying reason for it. And those underlying reasons can be multifactorial. It can be someone who's acutely ill. Mm-hmm. Some people become delirious just by simple dehydration, maybe constipation, uncontrolled pain. So any number of reasons can bring this on.
Are there personal traits or person's history that would indicate they are a higher risk, doctor?
I think when I bring someone in the hospital, particularly someone who has a history of cognitive impairment or dementia, I like to know if they've had a history of delirium in the past. And I like to know what's been helpful for trying to avoid that. And many times it's infection is a common cause, but dehydration, I think, is a major underrecognized reason as well as a cause.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nick Butler with us, if you just joined us, a geriatrician at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Tessie Myers, a nurse with the Veterans Administration Healthcare Center in Iowa City. Mary Mixdorf is with us. Her husband, before his death in 2016, experienced hospital delirium over the course, off and on, for the course of several years. Jill is listening. She writes this email. Jill writes, "It is infuriating in all caps, that it is not recognized more. Every time my dad has to go back to the hospital, this happens. It's basically ignored by almost all healthcare workers who are intent on shuffling him off somewhere else. In fact, most of them don't even recognize it because they don't spend very much time with him. Whatever is easiest seems to be the route taken by the various facilities." Jill, we're sorry to hear about the care there. Let's talk a little bit about this. Tessie Myers, I've done this talk show for 10 years, every single day. This is the first show I've done about hospital delirium. I've done every single major illness, disease under the sun,
And this is an exception, yet it seems to be very common.
It is very common, and especially in the intensive care unit. One thing that I think a lot of intensive care units are doing, including our own, is assessments of delirium. So there's specific tools that places use. What very common one is called CAM-ICU, and it basically assesses their cognitive function. And so you do that at least once, maybe twice a day, and then that will give you an indicator if this patient is developing delirium or how their mental status is. And so that is a tool that we have realized definitely needs to be done more, because you can't treat something that you're not aware of. So right. The awareness is really important.
Dr. Butler, why are we not good, it seems, at identifying and diagnosing this very common occurrence, ailment?
Yeah, I don't have a great answer for that, because I think from my standpoint, I try to be communicating with my nurses and my family, you know, the families of my loved ones, to try to be making sure that we're trying to identify this. But I think part of the frustration may come in the hypoactive delirium. I think, again, that one doesn't get the attention as much as the hyperactive delirium.
Hypo is the calmer, inward-looking. Hyper is the perhaps paranoid, violent, outward mm-hmm. expressions mm-hmm. of a patient, right?
Yeah, and as I take care of my patients, I like to know that history of delirium. That changes my communications with my nursing staff. That changes everything that as I try to approach that patient in terms of what we're going to do for them when they're in the hospital, in terms of trying to avoid as much interruption of their sleep, as much interruption of their normal eating, as much interruption of their normal life as we could. And granted, we should be doing these sorts of things anyways, mm-hmm. But by its very nature, unfortunately, with hospital-based care, it takes a lot of that normalcy out of it, and so I try to put as much of that back in. So I would encourage Jill to, you know, next time her loved one is being hospitalized, her dad's being hospitalized, that she really try to communicate with her providers of how this is presented in the past, how distressing it is for her, how distressing it is for other loved ones and for her dad, because I'm sure it's distressing for him, and just make sure that everyone's kind of on the same page for things.
As we finish up this conversation in the next 5 minutes, let me turn back to Mary Mixdorf, whose husband Gordon died in 2016 and had years before his death on and off bouts of delirium. Mary, this started for you. You dealt with it as the primary caregiver of your husband over the course of many years. What can you say to someone out there listening who has experienced some of this on how to cope with not only a loved one, a spouse, but how to deal with it in terms of working with healthcare providers so that you get the best possible care for a loved one?
That's hard, because you have changes of nurses, you have, you know, different doctors coming in. You don't really meet with, at least at the university, meet with the same person on a daily basis all the time. Sometimes you get a nurse that goes from one shift to another. I like the 12-hour shifts. Because it's, first of all, it's a scary thing, and it's not consistent. It's not the same thing every time. I think Gordon's incidents were different every time. Something else with new. And so that's confusing. You haven't had that experience before. Mm-hmm. And so to someone who's going through this, I think is ask questions, be patient, ask questions, and kind of bear with it. It does go away. I mean, many mornings I'd say, yeah, Gordon's back.
Right. But is it true that Dr. Butler, perhaps for you, that after one instance of delirium, is it more likely in the future? You should be really watchful of it in the future.
I think there's a predilection for it. If they've been able to become delirious in the past, I think absolutely they're at risk for it in the future. And I think, although I'm not going to say that because someone's delirious, they're going to develop dementia, but we do see higher rates of dementing illness in those who have had delirium in the past. And so dementia is a catch-all phrase for things like Alzheimer's disease, normal pressure hydrocephalus, Lewy body dementia, vascular dementia. So it is a catch-all disease or catch-all term. But I do think it's important that, you know, these people be monitored long-term for their long-term cognition, the long-term mental health.
Desi Myers, an RN here who's dealt with this and firsthand experience over years. What advice do you have for family members who are dealing with this issue to get the right care? What would you say?
The thing that is really hard for families and frustrating is there isn't a great treatment. There is no medicine that you give that makes this better. It's really about preventing it. But once you've noticed it, then it's already too late. So, I mean, it sounds so basic, but again, like good sleep hygiene, day-night schedules that are correct, and also connection with the outdoors can be very helpful to people. We've arranged to, you know, take patients who are on ventilators outside to try to help prevent some of these things, and those can make a big difference.
Mm-hmm. As a clinical professor, Nick Butler, what would you like to have done in the research area? What is there a question out there you would like to know the answer to concerning hospital delirium that would make life in the wards a lot easier?
You know, I think we have a decent idea of what it takes to prevent it, and prevention, I think, is the major thing. So from my standpoint, I agree with our emailer, increasing the public recognition that this is an issue, not just within healthcare professionals, but at you know, the general public, that they're aware that this is going on, that this is something that can happen, that they need to watch out for when either they go in the hospital, a loved one goes in the hospital, and that they're quick to bring it to the attention to us when we're caring for them.
Okay, we just have a few seconds left. Where can people go on the web to find reliable, credible information about this? Where would you go? Dr. Butler, do you have an answer for that?
I don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think there's resources. A delirium.org, but I'm not sure.
It goes to show how little and yes, how far we have to go in raising awareness about this. All right. Thank you very much. Desi Myers with the Iowa City Veterans Administration Health Care System, Dr. Nick Butler of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and Mary Mixdorf. Thank you all for coming in to have this conversation. And you can check out the mayoclinic.org. I just received a note from producer Emily Woodbury, mayoclinic.org, a good resource to find out more about hospital delirium. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, help today from Camus Leeson. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.